All right, we are back with another episode of the Kyle Anzalone Show, and I am really honored today to have on as my guest the great Colonel Douglas McGregor. Colonel McGregor, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Oh, great. I love that intro there. I thought I was watching a trailer for Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. It was really good.
I know producer Chris is backstage right now with a big smile on his face for that compliment. So thank you so much. We are a growing channel here. And of course, anybody who could share and follow this, it will be greatly appreciated. Colonel McGregor, I really want to spend some time talking to you today about this recent post that you made on X, which, I mean, you just do a fantastic job breaking down important things. But I also want to talk about Trump on sanctions and is Russia losing the war? So to start off with this post, I wanted to read one of the things that you write. Today, another hinge of history is swinging. Washington's unspoken fear of a 21st century turn is no less dramatic. Economic gravity shifts eastward, led by China and critically India. So, Colonel McGregor, I want to ask you, what led you to make this assessment?
Well, yeah. People have talked for a long time. Is there something wrong here?
Yeah, I'm hearing a little bit of an echo, too. Is there anything we do about that, Chris? All right. Chris says we're good.
Okay. All right. We've been talking for a long time about the fact that the world has recovered from the Second World War some time ago. And in 1991, we discovered that we had this enormous military establishment that proved to be very effective and effective without any sort of competition out here, allowing us to remake the world in our own image. So instead of, have I lost you?
No, we're good. We're good. No worries. Oh, nope. He is gone now. Sorry, we are having a couple tech issues. Hopefully, Colonel McGregor will be back here in just a second. I'm sure producer Chris is working on that. I thought this post by Colonel McGregor was extremely powerful because he really goes through, takes the time and breaks down what an important historical moment we are dealing with right now. And so, all right, I think we have Colonel McGregor back here.
Our relations with most of the world, and we did the opposite. And in the meantime, while the Chinese, for instance, invested $1 trillion in domestic infrastructure, and then subsequently another trillion plus in the One Belt, One Road project to build commercial rail and highways and trucking and so forth all across Eurasia, from Europe to China and down into the Middle East and Africa, we kept pouring trillions into the military without really looking at our own infrastructure, let alone the comparative advantages that we'd had in the past in commerce and trade that were evaporating. We weren't really adjusting to this new world. Now, the new world has fallen on us like a ton of bricks, and no pun intended. And now we're dealing with the reality that a lot of the global wealth and power that we took for granted for many, many years in Europe and the United States is literally flooding to the east. It's moving east, where the markets are, where the goods are, and the human capital exists. And so I thought I'd better write something on it. And it struck me that what happened in 1492 was a useful analogy, because in 1492, everybody remembers it as the end of Moorish occupation of Spain on the one hand, and on the other, Columbus's discovery of America. But what really happened is that all of the wealth and power that had resided in the Middle East and in Eurasia and ultimately in China and India began shifting towards Europe, because Europe had discovered this new source of enormous wealth in Latin America and North America. So we enjoyed this tremendous advantage of wealth that begins with Spain, spreads to France, Great Britain, and the Netherlands, and then ultimately to us for hundreds of years. we hadn't paid a great deal of attention to how things were changing in new directions. And actually speaking, over the last few years, we've offended much of the world by trying to bully it into submission. And we assumed that we were the only game in town, that no one could get along without our market. No one could get along without access to the American market. Well, that's turned out to be fundamentally false. The world's marketplace has now moved to China, Asia, and secondarily India. And I don't see any evidence that that's going to stop in the near future.
Yeah. So one of the other points that you make in this piece, you write, the oceans that once carried American commerce and projected U.S. power have become potential minefields. To move lumbering World War II style forces across the Pacific, Atlantic, or Indian Oceans today is not just dangerous, it borders on suicidal behavior. I know a lot of Americans would be shocked to learn that this massive military that we spend at least $1 trillion a year on, you're saying is unprepared for modern warfare?
Well, it's not just unprepared. It's frankly, in most cases, I think the best way to look at it is to look at it as the wrong solution to the problem. If we do have to fight, we have to understand what's changed. And things that were once our monopoly, our ability to exploit space-based surveillance, to exploit this vast array of sensors that we had created over many, many decades, and link all of that to missiles, rockets, aircraft, ships. In other words, the weapons of war is now no longer our monopoly. In fact, even mid-level nations have access to this sort of thing. So a quick example, if you tried to assemble a task force like the one that we assembled off the coast of Okinawa in 1944-45, and that assembled task force, by the way, was larger than the invasion of Normandy. Very few people realize that. But when we assembled that, we had complete control of the air, of the skies, of the sea. We were unchallenged except on land. And then ultimately we landed and we fought a really tough battle, which was by no means a straight-up victory for the United States. We were really humbled by the whole experience, and that's one of the reasons that we used the atom bomb later on. But the point I'm trying to make is that today, if you try to repeat that process, that various countries in the world, not exclusively China or Japan or Russia or Iran or anybody else, would sit back and watch this task force assemble literally on television from space. And once you assembled it within proximity to the target, which in this case was Okinawa, then you'd proceed to launch precision-guided weapons at it, missiles, which are perfectly accurate in terms of pinpoint accuracy, or you'd launch missiles from submarines or from the air or from the ground. Doesn't make any difference. And you'd rapidly destroy that task force. In other words, it would never get ashore. And they can track everything we do as we once were able to track everything everybody else did. In other words, our great advantages are no longer ours alone. And we can be victims of the very technologies that we first developed and expanded dramatically in the last century. So we can't fight in the future the way we fought in the past. And the other point I was trying to make is we don't have to. We are told that we live in this world of enemies, that we're in danger of being attacked by Russia, by China, by Iran, by any number of other countries. It's just not true. These countries have no interest whatsoever in going to war with us. In fact, if you sit down with the Chinese and the Indians, and they will tell you that our economy is vitally important to them, not in the sense that they can't live without us, because they can, but they'd like to live with us. In other words, they'd like to do business with us. We keep insisting that we have to control everything, and unless we're the dominant partner, we don't want any part in the play. This is a dead end. We live in a world today where we are not the only great power. We are one of many great powers. And we should get used to that and understand that there's no reason for us to bludgeon everybody over the head with the U.S. Armed Forces. We can actually be very successful. But we've got to turn back to the United States. We've got to go back to what are the things we do well. You know, and if you go back and look just between 1920 and 1970 in that 50-year period, We produced most of the inventions and breakthroughs in technology that have powered the world's economic engine. Well, what happened? Why aren't we doing that now? We have always had the great potential to be the world's engine of prosperity. That's what Washington forecasted. That's what every president since the beginning has talked about, except within the last 80 years, where we became so enamored of our military power that we sought this thing called military hegemony on the assumption that it would make the world safer for us. It's actually made the world a hell of a lot less safe for us because we've unnecessarily offended, alienated, and driven away people that otherwise would have been our allies.
Right. Well, I want to net, I have one more piece from your Eds post here, and I think this was really profound and really important, and I hope people really understand this. You write, the turning point came in 2022 when Washington responded to Russia's invasion of Ukraine with sweeping sanctions. The weaponizing the dollar was profound. The dollar looked less like a safe harbor and more like a trap door. From Riyadh to Delhi, from Brasilia to Beijing, capital saw the risk of conducting commerce in a currency that could be switched off at will. De-dollarization, once a theoretical debate, became an urgent strategy. And so I guess what you're laying out right here is the dollar losing its place as the world reserve currency, right?
Well, yes. And I think also we have to understand that people have just opted out of using the dollar. I mean, for a very long time, everybody did cross-border business and commerce with the dollar. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to turn to the Russians and say, we happen to have $300 billion in our banks that belong to you, we've decided we're going to keep it as punishment because you decided to intervene in eastern Ukraine to crush a threat that we had created. You don't want to play ball with us. We'll just keep your money. Well, imagine if you had money in a bank and you suddenly went in to make a withdrawal from the bank and you were told, I'm sorry, your money's not available. We've decided to redistribute it among other customers in the bank. How would you react? Well, the whole world has watched that, and they've discovered they can't trust us, that the dollar is not trustworthy. Not only do we pass on our debt because we're horribly indebted, as everybody knows, they've decided that the best thing to do is to stop using the dollar. The other thing is that they have all wanted, I'm talking about China, India, Russia, and the other BRICS members, Brazil and South Africa, now increasingly Saudi Arabia, Iran, they want to do business with currency that's backed by gold. Right now, the dollar only enjoys trust and confidence from the American people. And if that trust and confidence should wane, and I think we're close to that, then what's the dollar really worth? We don't have the gold to back it. So what does it mean? How much more valuable is it than, say, the Russian ruble? Well, the answer is it's not. Right now, the ruble is backed by gold, and so is the Chinese currency, and increasingly, that's where the world seems to be headed. That leaves us in Europe on the outside. Now, I'm not saying that we have to go to gold backing for our currency to work. There are other alternatives, but right now, we're not doing anything except printing more money. So everyone is inclined to walk away from us, Kyle.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case. Now, let's say President Donald Trump called you up tomorrow. What would you, can this be turned back? Is this like, are you saying that now we're in this process and it can't be undone? Is there anything that Trump could do to try to reverse this or at least slow it?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, there's no chance of him calling me. If he did, I would tell him something that I think he knows anyway. And I think he knew this when he first ran for office in 2016. You can go back and listen to him when he first started running, and he made some of these comments. We have to shed our overseas commitments. In other words, we have to demilitarize our relationships with Asia, with the Middle East and Africa and Latin America. This is not the world where we can sail around in a battleship, lower the guns, and threaten people unless they open their economies to us and do business with us on our terms. Excuse me, those days are over.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
So I think he knows that, but he's been unable to do it. Some of that is because people are telling him not to, and some of it is because of the opposition on the Hill, because people are heavily invested in the status quo. But you've got to shed these overseas commitments. You've got to pull back on all of these tariffs. When he launched this tariff war, if he had essentially launched a tariff attack, if you will, on China initially, people probably would have understood that. But when you talk about imposing tariffs on your old trading partners, you know, India, Great Britain, Germany, Spain, why? What's the rationale for it? How have they harmed us? And the answer is they haven't harmed us, nor will they unless we harm them. And right now we're harming them. That's why I made the point about India. India is not as large as China economically, but it's growing rapidly. It's an important economy. If you put China and India together in terms of purchasing power, they're twice the size of the United States as economies together. So I think we have to understand that you can't bully them anymore. They'll just turn away from you, and that's what the Indians are doing. We told them that we were going to impose a 50% tariff on them because they continue to buy Russian oil and gas. Well, you know, Washington said many, many years ago when he was president, he was asked by someone, I can't remember who it was, about the French and what would they do in the future. And he made the point, no nation can be expected to move beyond the limits of its own interests. We have to understand that. Donald Trump has been in the business of asking states to effectively commit suicide. Well, the Germans have given a pretty good imitation of that right now, but the rest of Europe is not very enthusiastic about it. The Turks, for instance, are heavily dependent upon the oil and gas they get from Russia. They have this thing called TurkStream. They're not our enemies, but they're not going to go along with this. And India isn't going to go along with it. So the Indians, though, in contrast to the Turks, had a little bit more leverage. So the Indians have turned around and said, well, you remember that $35 billion deal that we closed with Boeing for new aircraft? Well, we're going to pull that deal out. In other words, $35 billion that support 150,000 people working for the Boeing Corporation is not going to be there. The Indians are going to keep it and say, we'll go elsewhere and buy aircraft from someone else. That's the problem right now. You don't live in a world where everything is your way or the highway. And unfortunately, President Trump has taken that position. My way or the highway. So people are taking the highway. Goodbye.
Yeah, and I actually want to play this clip of you. This is Trump's most recent remarks discussing future sanctions on Russia and its trading partners.
Europe is, they're my friends, but they're buying oil from Russia. So we can't be expected to be the only ones that are, you know, full bore. But Europe is buying oil from Russia. I don't want them to buy oil. And the sanctions that they're putting on are not tough enough. And I'm willing to do sanctions, but they're going to have to toughen up their sanctions commensurate with what I'm doing.
So the question for you, Colonel McGregor, is what do you think of Trump's strategy here? Is this going to be effective?
Short answer is obviously no. But I think that President Trump, if he were a truly great leader, and, you know, he still is presented to everyone as the leader of the quote-unquote free world, I think that's a misnomer, but he certainly leads the Western world. If he's going to be the leader of the Western world, it's time to step forward and say, look, this proxy war that we launched against Russia back in 2022 has failed. There is no point in continuing it. If we persist in this, there will no longer be a Ukrainian state. So at this point, I am withdrawing all support from this war and from this regime in Kiev, and I am urging Kiev to ask for terms from Moscow. We will certainly support whatever terms are negotiated, We will help in any way we can, but this war is now over. And by the way, there is nothing to prevent Europeans or Americans or Indians or Turks or anybody else from doing business with Russia if it is in their interest to do so. But you see, we lived in this world for so long where we thought of ourselves as really the only game in town that we can't make this leap in logic. We can't come around to understanding that there are limits to our power. There are limits to our interest. We have no vital strategic interest in Ukraine. We never did. Certainly no interest in Eastern Ukraine. We do have an interest in normalizing relations with Russia. And I think President Trump knows that as well. So let's go ahead and do it. And then work to get the best possible terms we can for the Ukrainians. Because the Russians obviously have the ability to cross that river and march all the way to the Polish border. They don't want to go. We don't want them to go. They don't need to go there. So let's end the war. That's what a great leader does. What he's doing is this sort of passive-aggressive nonsense that says, well, if you Europeans aren't going to live up to the bargain, then I guess maybe we can't too. That's leadership. That's absurd. It's appalling. And he should be disgusted with himself.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think he is. Now, the last clip I have for you today is Keith Kellogg. This is Trump's envoy to the Ukraine conflict, discussing his assessment of the battlefield.
If he was winning, he'd be in Kyiv. If he's winning, he'd be west of the Dnieper River. If he's winning, he'd be on Odessa. If he's winning, he would have changed the government. Russia is, in fact, losing this war. Now, they may make movements and say, so, well, they're advancing in the Donbass region in the Donetsk. But if you consider advancing, moving by meters, not miles, well, then, okay, that's successful. But at the cost that they're having, it's enormous. And I don't think people truly appreciate it. It's a number. But the numbers they have lost, when you're talking dead and wounded, well over a million. They left Afghanistan after losing 18,000. We left Vietnam after losing 65,000. They have lost over a million dead or wounded. These numbers are World War II level numbers when you think about it. They're stunning in the loss. And this is in their first line units that they came and tried to take Kyiv with a little over four years ago. Those first line units are gone. So they've gone through a second or third or fourth iteration of wartime commanders. They're pulling tanks out of mothballs, out of museums to put on the battle line. They can't operate in large movements because the Ukrainians will kill them.
So, Colonel McGregor, what do you make of Kellogg's assessment of the conflict? Is Russia losing this war?
Obviously not. I think we have to view General Kellogg as perhaps the leader of the coalition of the deluded. He's operating on the basis of information that is fundamentally false. We know that the Ukrainians have now lost somewhere between 1.7 and 1.8 million dead Ukrainian soldiers. The Russians have lost somewhere between 110 to 120,000 killed, and perhaps another 100,000 wounded, most of whom have returned to duty. Now, that's very important because the million or so casualties beyond the dead that the Ukrainians have sustained will never come back to duty. They're so badly wounded, they receive such terrible care and poor evacuation that there's no chance of those men ever returning to the battlefield. So return to duty is very important. The Ukrainians are in no position to do anything. And that's why the most humane thing we could do is to intervene and put an end to this. Now, why would General Kellogg state these bold-faced lies? Well, first, it may be that he wants desperately to believe this. And there is a habit in Washington of believing in what you want to believe, regardless of the facts. If you go back to Vietnam in 1967, within the last 6 to 8 months of the year, William Westmoreland and McNamara and a host of other people were crossing back and forth around the United States, giving lectures to everybody on how we had turned the corner in Ukraine, or excuse me, in Vietnam. We were on the verge of winning. And then in January of 68, the Tet Offensive occurred. And we did inflict during the offensive tremendous losses on the Vietnamese. But the Vietnamese at the time from the north demonstrated conclusively that we had not won the war. We had not turned any corner. That the war was a bottomless pit for resources and American manpower. That it was befuddled. We didn't know what we were doing. We were lost. And so the American people turned away from it. Johnson decided not to run for re-election, and the rest is history. Well, we're in a similar position right now in Ukraine. We went in there with the goals of harming Russia. Remember the statements that were made by Biden early on? Well, we're there to harm the Russians, to degrade them, to push this man Putin out of office, who is a dictator, has very weak support, and really will not sustain the losses that they're starting to take. All of that was utter and complete nonsense. So here we are, 3+ years later, and we know where we're headed. We're headed to a Russian victory. Now, what does that victory look like? We seem to demand that the Russians march to the Polish border, which I don't think is in the interest of the Russians. They know the people in Western Ukraine don't want to be ruled from Moscow. They're perfectly willing to live with that. They simply will not tolerate Ukraine's membership in NATO. They want a neutral state in Ukraine, just as we have a neutral state today in Austria. That's what the Russians are looking for. And that makes perfect sense. Would we tolerate an alliance between Mexico and, say, China and the presence of Chinese troops in Mexico? Of course not. The Russians are in very much the same position. We almost went to war over Cuba, an island 100 miles off the coast of the United States, for many of the same reasons. And we're acting as though this is incomprehensible in Moscow. It's not. It makes perfect sense. This war needs to end. And people like Kellogg should be sent off to the old folks' home, find a nice card game, let him go there and join it with his old friends, and he'll be fine. But he has no business in international relations. The other thing that's so frustrating is that he, like so many other Americans, know nothing about Russia or Eastern Europe, or I would say Europe in general. They don't know the history. They don't know what's happened there. They don't understand the people, the culture, the languages, the religion. And this, again, is what we went through in Vietnam. We went through it in Iraq. I mean, I remember people coming back and saying exactly what Robert McNamara said. McNamara said, well, you know, the problem in Vietnam is we never understood the culture. Gee, what a blinding flash of the obvious. We never understood the people in Iraq either. The whole thing has been a catastrophe. We need to get out of this business. And that's really what that essay is also about. Get out of the business of trying to meddle in other people's societies and tell them how to live. And of course, that brings us to the most recent example, which is the potential disaster over the horizon called Venezuela. You know, how are we going to improve the drug problem inside the United States by attacking Venezuela? We're not. You know, there are people using drugs. There are people in the United States selling drugs. Crack down on the network. Get control of your borders, your ports, your airports, your harbors. You know, we have good optics right now on the border. Things look much better because there aren't tens of thousands of people lining up to pour into the country through open borders. That's good. But we still don't have control of the legal crossing points, the ports of entry, where the drug cartels can pay people $30,000 extra every month just to look the other way, while drugs and human trafficking continues through the legal ports of entry. We're having people turn the other way when trucks that are full of cash, millions of dollars in hard cash, are driven from north of the border to south of the border to pay the cartels for their drugs and their criminal activity in the U.S. We've got to get down to brass tacks here in the United States. We've got to go after the problem here at home, not down in Venezuela. And by the way, if you want to do business with Venezuela, they'll do business with you. But they're not going to do business with you when you put a bayonet to their throats. And that's effectively what we're trying to do. So that's why I say President Trump has not learned any of the critical lessons, even though I think inwardly he understands these things, but he hasn't learned it.
Colonel McGregor, thank you so much for coming on my show today and sharing all of your really great insights. I've been reading you for quite some time, but I remember in late 2021, early 2022, you were one of the few voices predicting and warning about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it's so unfortunate that so many people didn't take what you were saying seriously, because maybe we could have avoided at least some part of this catastrophe. And so all of your analysis has been fantastic, and it's a real honor to have you here today. I hope I can have you back one day in the future.
Well, Kyle, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. You have a great program. I look forward to seeing it more often in the future.
Thank you.
Right.